podcast this week, we say, "Talk to me." And then no actor or writer responds. But we support them. We support them. We stand with them, stick to the man, etc., etc. Anyway, we say, "Talk to me," to the Talk to Me director, Danny Philippou. Plus, the usual news and nonsense on the movie podcast that went full Barbenheimer this week and has barely recovered, to be honest. Hello, Pod. I'm Chris Hewitt. Welcome to the Empire Podcast. I'm back in the chair after a couple of weeks away. Please accept my apologies for the shocking and marked increase in quality that happened over the last couple of weeks when Helen was hosting. That won't happen again. I'm like Superman turning up at the end of Superman 2 and saying, "Good afternoon, Mr. President. I let you down. It won't happen again." It's basically that. Not on my watch. This podcast will not become listenable. Not on my watch. Anyway, I'm joined by two colleagues of such lethal cunning. I feel very much like the Ken in this situation. My Kenergy levels are high. But Sophie Butcher is here.
Hi, Ken.
Hi, Sophie.
Hi. I'm still doing it. We did it last week.
I know we did.
Hi, Oppie.
Hi, Barbenheimer. Hi, Einstein.
Hi, yeah. What is that name be? Einie?
Albie? Hi, Albie.
Isn't Einie what Doc Brown calls his dog whenever he's got a dog called Einstein? He calls him Einie. I'm pretty sure the nickname is Einie.
Oh, Einie.
Copernicus is another Doc Brown name. Not his name, but his dog name. He has a dog called Copernicus and another one called Einstein. Anyway, Helen O'Hara, our geek queen, is here.
Hello.
How are you both?
Very, very well.
Good.
I'm still kind of surfing the Barbie high, to be honest.
Good.
I really am.
Surfing the pink wave.
Yes. No, that sounds biological in a bad way. Let's not go there.
Oh, God. Anyway, patriarchy. Should we talk about it? The patriarchy has been restored, by the way. Phew, thank God. For a second there, I thought this had been overtaken by females. Not females, no, God. God. High Ben Shapiro levels of energy here going on.
I love that he's done. Well, you know the way, okay, so Ben Shapiro, for anybody who doesn't know, and God bless you if you don't, he's one of these US obnoxious right-wing commentators. And he has in total done, I believe, an hour and 45 minutes on Barbie. For his, I guess, YouTube channel or some kind of video channel.
Yeah, he's got a lot of YouTubers.
So he's basically kind of done what we do for, you know, Avengers movies for Barbie, but from a place of hate.
It's like you on a Chris Nolan film.
Hey, I don't hate Chris Nolan films. I just have some well-founded reservations.
I respect his right to exist.
I'm just asking questions.
If I go down a rabbit hole every now and again, that's totally fine. Yes. Let's not give too much time and attention to
Ben Shapiro. No, absolutely not. That was more than enough.
I saw a thumbnail. I didn't pay any attention to it. I didn't actually click on it, but it said he destroys Barbie for 43 minutes. And I don't want to give away spoilers for Barbie, but I can see that he probably saw himself in that film a lot more than he might have anticipated and reacted accordingly. Mm-hmm. So that's my guess on that one. The Cancel Hive is mobilizing. The cancellation? Cancel culture?
Don't throw Ken in with those guys.
Let's not tarnish Ken with that brush.
He means
he
well.
He learned.
Okay. Which one? Anyway, I Barbenheimered.
You did.
I did.
Yeah.
Mm.
And you finished at what time in the morning?
Physically, I finished at 2:30 in the morning on Tuesday. Mentally, I finished at somewhere around 1 a.m. It was a very, very interesting experience. I triple billed.
You did?
On, was it Tuesday night? I want to say Tuesday
Monday.
Night. Was it Monday?
No, Monday. Because today's Wednesday.
No, it was Tuesday night because I interviewed the director of the film that I can't say yesterday. And I was still on the Barbenheimer. Mm. I was still in the stupor, quite frankly. So I saw this secret film that you will never be able to work out what it is. I saw a secret film at 6:45, something like that. And then when that was over, I hightailed it out of the screening, raced back to Greenwich, had booked a ticket to see Barbie at the local Odeon. And then whenever that was over, got in just as it was starting. So I missed like the first 45 seconds or so.
Okay.
So this may mean I'm not qualified to do the spoiler special.
I may
disqualify myself.
It's really significant.
It is hugely significant. And then I went straight, well, not straight, because there was a half hour pause. I went into Oppenheimer, which started at the IMAX, because I wanted to see it in IMAX, although it was a Limax. I saw it in glorious IMAX, 3 hours, finished at 2:30, had to get an Uber home, stopped off for a kebab because I hadn't eaten in 12 hours and the kebab shop was open, like just like, you know, this glorious...
glowing.
Yeah, yeah, like
haven.
An oasis.
Yeah, yeah, on the horizon.
Very much like the Trinity sequence from Oppenheimer.
Oh, God.
My face just lit up too soon. And yeah, so I went in, had a kebab, and then didn't get to bed until 3:30. Then got up at like 7 because I had to edit stuff. Anyway, it's good. I'm feeling great. I'm feeling good about my choices.
Your life is a miracle. I mean,
how I'm still alive.
How you're not dead is genuinely, it's astonishing. Scientists will one day study you.
I've weekended Bernie to myself.
You have.
I actually died some years
ago. You've been puppeting your own dead body yeah. for at least the last 10 years.
A complicated series of pulleys and levers have been keeping me alive for some time.
I have to say, it was wonderful seeing the atmosphere around cinemas this weekend. And
it was.
I saw no less than 3 groups of girls dressed entirely in pink walk past my kitchen window. And I thought, I know where you're going.
Mission Impossible. Dead Reckoning Part 1.
It filled me with joy to see it.
I am almost like suspicious now of anyone I see wearing pink,
it's like,
or a fedora.
I know where they're going. Well, it's interesting because I didn't see too many people cosplaying for Oppenheimer, but I feel that Oppenheimer is cosplay of the soul in that you come out of that movie as Oppenheimer. You just come out a wreck of a person. With, you know, like Cillian Murphy just staring into the middle distance. That's basically, you know, I'm not going to denigrate his performance. He's astounding and he will be Oscar nominated, I'm guessing. Who knows? Maybe he'll even win. Finally, justice for Jackson Ripner. But the performance at the Oscars overlooked in 2005. Red Eye, really good film. Anyway,
I mean,
it's a good film.
That's the one you're picking out of his back catalog.
No, listen, I will say that I really admired Oppenheimer. I think that I probably wasn't in the best mental state to take it in at 11:30 in the morning.
At night.
But I will say that I think it's terrific. I think 5 stars is correct. I think we should also 5-starred Barbie.
I agree.
I think Barbie is absolutely tremendous. Hey, Sophie. Enough with the Kennergy.
I would go 4 that's on not, both,
that's,
personally.
That's not Kenough. Do you want to be a victim of cancel culture or not?
Hey.
You got to stow it.
I'm a Barbie. You should be supporting me.
All right. Okay. Anyway, I still think that the best Cillian Murphy movie revolving around a nuclear device is Sunshine.
Great movie.
And I still think the best Robert Downey Jr. film over 3 hours long is Avengers Endgame. But anyway, I would, wouldn't I? Because I'm me. But it was a really interesting experience. I know a lot of people have done Barbenheimer and they've talked about the order in which you should do it. And we devoted the whole part of the show to that a couple of weeks ago. Honestly, tonally, I was fine with it. I was fine with the tonal whiplash because I host the Empire podcast. But everything else about it was just it was the time. It was the late night. And frankly, it was my seatmates for Oppenheimer who made it a very interesting experience. I don't want to throw anyone under a bus, although I did try. There were no buses at that time of night, so I couldn't throw this person under a bus. I sat down, picked a really good seat, IMAX pre-booked, went along, sat down, bang, middle of the row,
correct.
Middle of the screen, perfect
correct.
Seat, mm-hmm. right? I don't know who's sitting next to me. Just sheer potluck. There was a lady who I think had been a little bit, how should we say, enhanced with the addition of some beverage.
She was drunk.
Yes, Helen, thank you. I don't want to throw anyone under the bus.
I genuinely wasn't sure what you meant.
Yeah, she was a cyborg, is basically what I'm saying. And this is no word of a lie. Absolutely 100% this happened. The movie is starting. The titles are starting. She turns to her companion and says, out loud, which she proceeded to do for the entire movie, by the way. What's this about?
I knew you were going to say that.
What's this about? And then proceeded, and it wasn't too bad, but proceeded to just like every now and again, just pepper commentary or pepper questions at her companion, but in an outside voice. Mm. How could she tell me that due to the unfreezing process, she has no inner monologue? So, Robert Downey Jr. pops up, one of the most famous faces on the planet, the star of Avengers Endgame, of course.
Thanks for clarifying, Chris.
She goes,
that guy.
Yeah. Oh, Tony.
Oh, Tony. Spoilers there for Avengers Endgame.
I've got to do it. It's tradition. She goes, is that Robert Downey Jr.? Out loud. And Matt Damon, another famous person, shows up. where have I seen him before? She
Matt
goes.
Damon.
And then she goes, oh. And then she realizes what she'd seen him in, which was nice. And then there's a bit where Oppenheimer is being grilled about his political beliefs, which is pretty much the entire film. But and she goes, are they asking him about his political beliefs? I at one
Seriously?
Point, yeah, I thought I was sitting next to Diane Kunk at one point. I wasn't entirely sure, but she had clearly been dragged along. She was there under duress. She was loaded up on snacks, just an endless array of snacks. I thought she was Mary fucking Poppins at one point. It's just like a bag, an endless, bottomless bag. Like, how many packs of crisps can you possibly produce?
That's you quite know? Some dragging to 11:30 showing of a three-hour movie on a school night.
On a Tuesday night, I think it was very much, look, I want to see this movie. I really want to go see this movie. They, you know, this is the only time I can get a really good seat. Will you come with me? All right, then.
Yeah.
But to not ask what it's about until you sit down and it starts, was an interesting
It's a choice.
Flex.
It's definitely a choice.
Yeah.
I had a slightly similar thing. I went to a special screening, they called it. It was originally going to be a premiere, but, you know, strikes, of Haunted Mansion last night.
Ooh.
And, I mean, first of all, there's insane security now getting into a lot of the big screenings that we go to. This one was very special. They had a bag search. They sort of wandered you down with one of those security wands. They made you drink from any bottles of water you were carrying to be sure that they were water. They made one woman in front of me unfold her fold-up shopping bag to make sure it was a folded-up shopping bag. I guess they were worried about sort of Just Stop Oil type flags or something. I have no idea. It was very mysterious to me. And then you get in and walk past a bunch of, you know, foam set dressing things. And they foist one of these. We get these little plastic bags that they tell us to put our phone in at screenings for, you know, obviously anti-piracy purposes. And then, but if you leave the cinema, say, to go to the loo, they try to give you another plastic bag on your way back in just to make sure you definitely have one to put your phone in, which didn't stop the influencer next to me texting every 5 minutes through the movie or checking her phone. And it's like, I mean, what?
Might have been the same person.
Bad.
I wonder if she was at a Talk to Me screening last week, because I also had a very similar experience.
Like, if you're just going to this for the photos, can you not just turn up, walk the whatever color carpet it was, take your photos, and then go home? If you're that disinterested in the film, just go home.
Yeah.
It's just, you're in the, I was in Talk to Me, it's an hour and a half long, it's not a long film, and it's very dark, and the guy's phone screen next to me was very distracting.
Mm-hmm.
You can live for that long without messaging someone. That's all I'm saying.
Anyway, these are first world problems.
They are.
First world problems. Anyway, should we have a question?
Yeah.
Okay, so I may have... Helen was organized last week and actually asked for the question ahead of time.
I did. It was amazing.
I asked for the question 3 minutes after walking into this room. Here's one from Clark Dickey, Dicky Mint on Twitter. Yes, I'm still on Twitter, or X, as it's now apparently called.
Oh, my absolute nightmare.
I refuse, to quote Helen, I absolutely refuse. No, thank you. I do not consent. Still Twitter. I'm still tweeting. anyway, Clark Dickey on Twitter has seated, and he says, what questions shouldn't you ask in an interview? What's the worst reaction you've had?
Okay, so I don't have an exact answer for this, but it does remind me of something I was talking about to some friends this morning, which was misidentifications. We were talking about like bad things that have happened in interviews that we've done or that we've seen or that we're aware of. So the person on the red carpet once at the London Film Festival who misidentified, she thought she was talking to Ken Loach. She was in fact talking to Mike Lee. And that is a mistake that, believe me, you do not want to make.
Nah.
So that is number one. Know who you're talking to. That would be a super good start, I think, in any interview. But that then reminded me of a story I just heard from someone I interviewed for the magazine for a feature that will be in a future issue of Empire, who was talking about having been on set of a film with Matt Damon. And everybody was very excited about Matt Damon showing up because he's been in many good things. And somebody on the film went up to him, and you'll like this, Chris, started complimenting his work in Instant Family and saying how much it meant to that person and how much they loved it. He apparently could not have been nicer and more gracious. And talked to this person for several minutes about, yes, how wonderful Instant Family was, but that was, in fact, of course, Mark Wahlberg. But left everybody feeling good about themselves and not, you know, didn't.
That's very
didn't
gracious.
A diva about the whole thing. I was impressed. I thought that's some good work right there by Matt Damon. So yay to him. Anyway, that wasn't really the question, but I just wanted to share it.
It's so like Margot Robbie's and Emma Mackey and Samara Weaving are sort of incessantly asked about looking like each other. Right. Every time I see a clip of Margot Robbie answering that question, I'm like, she must be sick of that by now.
I do feel you could make a really good online game, right? Where you it's like a speed round and you have to very quickly identify which is which.
Like that game where there's several circles and one's not quite the same colour as the other and it gets harder. Have you done that on TikTok? But with those actors.
Yeah.
I haven't done a ton of interviews, so I haven't had any like real bad ones or anything go down really badly.
Who have you interviewed? Did you interview anyone before you started this job? I mean, what was your journalistic experience? I obviously didn't interview Sophie for a job. What sort of journalistic experience did you have?
I'd done a few freelance bits. I'd interviewed a couple people, smaller directors like Lucy Bryden and Eva Riley.
Okay.
I interviewed Kate Blanchett for the Q&A section in Empire.
Okay,
John commissioned me on that one. She was very lovely and had 10 minutes.
Was that your first Empire thing? Your first Empire interview?
No. Lucy Bryden, who directed a film called Body of Water, was my first Empire interview,
right,
which Terry commissioned me to do.
And how was that? Were you nervous?
I was all right because I'd spoken to her before, because I'd seen the film at Glasgow Film Festival that year and I'd spoken to her then. But with, you know, with bigger names, you get nervous. And I did my first in-person interview. I've only ever done one in-person interview, which was Melanie Lynskey for Yellow Jacket Season 2 with a junket.
She's amazing.
A few months ago, she was lovely.
Oh, love
her. Yeah.
So my point was, you don't go into these interviews basically asking people about their political leanings, sex life. These are the sort of things that we kind of steer clear.
Empire doesn't want that sort of thing. No. We're very focused on the work, right? So it's always a bit easier.
I think it is. I think I'm always very, very grateful that I don't have to do that stuff. And as a freelancer, I've occasionally had to ask other people about elements of their life outside their work, but never anything I was uncomfortable with because I don't work for those papers, basically. Mm. But I have known, you know, people whose job it is, and they're literally told, you don't come back until you get a quote on X or Y. You know, it's sort of, they are put under a lot of pressure to ask this stuff, and thank God that isn't us. I do remember once going into an interview with Jennifer Aniston for The Breakup, and you remember that was around the time of her breakup, and every question must have been about Bradgelina, like I think everyone. And I swear to this day, I walked into the room and they said, this is Helen from Empire, and I saw her shoulders go down about 3 inches, like, oh, thank fuck. She's not going to ask me about the fucking marriage.
Yeah.
And I mean, maybe it was an optical illusion, but I'm pretty convinced that actually happened. So I feel like we have, you know, the good fortune to be talking to people about stuff that they care about, but that isn't, hopefully at least, wildly awkward, personal and horrific to discuss.
Yeah, I remember talking to Ben Affleck for Daredevil. So this would have been around 2003. And there was a fair amount of chicanery going on because initially he wasn't available. This was around the whole Bennifer thing, part one.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I think he was turning shit down left, right and center. And eventually, you know, we got him and it was just like, dude, I couldn't give a shit about your personal life. I do not care. I wish you all the best, obviously, but I do not care. I do care about you playing Daredevil. And I'd like to talk to you about that for 20 minutes, if that's okay. That's what I said in my mind. But, you know, he got the gist. You know, so we don't tend to do that. In terms of things you don't ask about, was that the question? I can't remember. It's already disappeared from my phone. But, you know, worst reactions. I've said it before, the Woody Harrelson thing where he walked out on me when I did a public access interview with him. You know, but that's fine. You know, he was clearly having a bad day. People are allowed to have a bad day.
Yeah,
totally
this
fine.
Is it. You get them in different moods. People, if they've been doing a junket for a long time, or if, you know, people are different every time you have to sort of meet them where they are, I think.
Mm. Yeah, it's interesting. It's interesting. But yeah, who was your first person for Empire, Helen?
One-on-one was the junket for Connie and Carla, and I think it was David Duchovny.
Wow.
Ooh. Yeah, it was either him or Nia Vardalos. It was the same day. But that was actually a lot of fun. That was good.
Wow.
I did some round tables though, as a sort of, we did more round tables back in the day for the website. So basically a round table is several journalists and a person. And journalists aren't people, of course. And
scum of the earth.
But that does kind of ease you in, actually, because it means that you don't have the responsibility of carrying the entire interview on your own. And it was a very good learning experience to most of the time sit there and go, well, I wouldn't ask that. Jeez. But sometimes go, oh, that's a good question. I wonder if I can, you know, use a spin on that in future.
It is wild. I remember Ian Freer coming back from a science junket. I think it was Ian Freer. So when was science? 2003? Again, yeah, 2002? No, 2002. Yeah. Science 2002. So he came back from a science junket and said that people had, you know, because we're obviously jaded and cynical ourselves, but there are some journalists that you meet on the junket circuit who are just like, they're just empty vessels that are, you know, being pushed along. They have no souls. They have no love for the medium. They have no love for any of it. They've been doing this for years. They become kind of desiccated husks that occasionally ask questions at round tables. Sometimes they don't ask anything, but when they do, sometimes watch out, because they have no filter and they don't give a fuck. Mm-hmm. Some of these people may or may not have been associated with the Hollywood Foreign Press Association. I couldn't possibly say. But apparently at the science junket, some journalists just kept asking Joaquin Phoenix about River.
Oh, and just, that's terrible.
And would not leave it alone. And it's just extraordinary to me that people would do that. I've seen shit like that before. You know, I've said this on the podcast before, but I remember very, very well a Billy Bob Thornton roundtable for Bad Santa at Cannes years ago, where it was so much fun and he was having so much fun and he was in such a good mood and the film's terrific and everyone was loving it. And he went around the table and went, hey, well, okay, what did you guys think of the movie? You know, marks out of 10. And everyone was going, 8, 9, 7, great. You know, and then he got to one woman and she was like, 0. And wasn't doing a bit. She just genuinely thought the film was just reprehensible. And that just dive bombed the interview from that point on, because he tried to laugh it off and go, ha ha ha, you're entitled to your opinion. Like, okay, you know, what did you like about it? What did you dislike about it? And she literally said, I thought it was reprehensible. I thought it was morally disgusting and all that sort of stuff. And he went, ha ha ha, and then tried to move on. And then he just couldn't shake it. And he came back to her and he's like, okay, hang on a second. And then it just turned into a Barney between the two of them for
the
next 5 minutes.
You wouldn't be able to shake it, would you?
You couldn't shake it.
If you look at it from their perspective, they need to be professional, but it's their work that they've spent a long time on.
I get her impulse to be honest. That's commendable. You shouldn't have to lie and everything. But at the same time, you know, there's a way to do it so you still get an interview. So I don't know if she shot herself in the foot. Maybe she didn't care.
It felt very confrontational. It felt like she'd been offended by the movie personally and it was taking it out on him.
My favorite is not a question you shouldn't ask in an interview, but certainly something you shouldn't do.
Or have you ever been a member of the Communist Party?
That's actually a solid one to avoid.
It's a good opener.
It could be quite fun in an Oppenheimer junket, actually.
Write that down, Sophie, because I know you're talking to Danny Philippou later on for Talk to Me. Start with that.
That. What a great opener, Sophie. Yeah, great.
Favorite sexual position. Straight into that.
Yep.
And I was going to start with,
what's the worst thing that's ever happened to you?
Yeah. Talk to me.
No. I love it. 10 out of 10.
You'll find out in a bit when you hear the interview.
Yes.
Whether I did it or not.
Yeah. My biggest piece of advice is not a question you shouldn't ask. It's something you shouldn't do. And it was, you know, it may or may not be a member of that august body that you mentioned before, Chris, who was on a junket with me at Pixar. And if you go to Pixar, they will sort of shepherd you around round tables with various heads of departments, so lighting and, you know, storyboarding and layout and so on. And these people are a little bit more technical than some interviewers are used to. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, they are fascinating. You learn a lot about how Pixar works, how Pixar thinks from these interviews. I find them really, really enjoyable.
And a lot about yourself.
It's such a great opportunity for self-reflection.
At Pixar that the magic was inside me all along.
Oh, you know what? I thought that. It must be, because it's keeping your dead body upright, you know. But this one woman who was with me on this junket fell asleep.
She fell asleep
during not one, not two, but three different round tables of 20 minutes each.
Oh, come on now.
Now, look, if maybe she has narcolepsy, in which case I apologize for making fun of a genuine affliction.
A genuine affliction, but we must also emphasize hilarious affliction.
But I don't think she did. I think she was just one of those people who's maybe not super professional.
Jaded? Cynical?
Yeah, all of the above.
Nick, again, I told the story before and I'm going to wrap it up with a story that I've told before because I only have three stories. And if you listen to the podcast long enough, you will hear them all on a fucking endless loop. But Nick, also a Can, because Can obviously brings out a lot of junket hacks, right? So Nick, this is years ago, right? Was doing a round table with Ben Mendelsohn and I can't remember what the project was, but they were sitting down. No. They were sitting down, and one of the journalists was going, Who is this Ben Mendelsohn guy? Does anyone know anything about this Ben Mendelsohn guy? And started talking to the person next. Do you know anything about this Ben Mendelsohn guy? And he's going, and this guy's going, no, don't know anything about Ben Mendelsohn at all. Listeners, it's become apparent by now that Ben Mendelsohn was already sitting down and she was talking to Ben Mendelsohn Ben Mendelsohn knew who Ben Mendelsohn was.
Ben Mendelsohn could be in this room right now.
Well, yeah.
He
could be.
He was everyone in that room, actually.
Room. Didn't... Yes. Don't remind me of Secret Invasion.
My favorite starter to a round table was, again, a mad person.
Prong Cocktail.
We were going into the final Twilight movie round table. Oh. It was in LA. Oh.
Seminal text.
Yeah. Seminal text.
Seminal text. And this woman starts asking the person next to her, what happened to Jacob in this movie? What happened? And this person started explaining that Jacob imprints on the baby, which is admittedly a mad plot point. Okay. And she was taken aback by this.
It's cancelable, I think.
It's cancelable. And so when you know, the very nice, very down-to-earth Taylor Lautner comes into the room, like a guy who could not be more anxious to answer everyone's questions well and be friendly and be helpful and everything.
Shirt
else.
On or shirt off?
Shirt on.
I'm talking about you.
Obviously shirt off for me. Yeah, obviously.
Of course.
And literally the first 5 minutes of the interview were just her going, I could not believe it. They tell me what happened. I could not believe it. You fall in love with the baby. And he's going, well, no, it's a bit more complicated than that. I didn't, you know, fall in love. It's a sort of a weird imprinting. I could not believe it.
Oh, why is she making him defend that? He didn't write it.
It's not his fault, God bless him.
It's not his fault.
That's an amazing accent. Was she also after the fall of Madonna with the big boobies by any chance?
Was.
Jesus Christ.
She really was.
That's wild. All right, I'm going to finish it off with, stop me if you've heard this one before, but I was going to the set of Iron Man in what would have been 2007, obviously the first MCU movie, on a bus. This was back in the days when, you know, I was being part of round tables, don't pull that shit with me anymore, Marvel. But anyway... I was on a bus with a bunch of other journalists going to the set. We get to the security gate. A journalist leans over to me. A Russian journalist leans over to me. And again, no word of a lie. Who is this Iron Man? And then 15 years later, she bought a ticket to see Oppenheimer. And brought it all full circle. That's Iron Man. 15 years later, that's Iron Man. The guy who's trying to take down Oppie. Cancel him. Cancel him
Excuse
immediately.
Oppie is a Mars rover, and I feel personally attacked by that real life nickname for J. Robert Oppenheimer. I'm just saying.
Why do you feel attacked by that? How's that attacking
it's
you?
It's a Mars rover. It's disrespectful to per opportunity.
But Oppenheimer's nickname predated that.
Well, so you say.
That probably wouldn't have been possible without
Helen's consciousness.
Oppie.
Well.
You're just an opportunist. Whereas I'm an equal opportunist. And no one's going to be canceling me. That's for damn sure. If you want to have your question read out in the Empire podcast, I don't know.
Why would
fucking
you?
Beam it with a laser into the moon. I don't know. Threads, blue sky. Here's a challenge. You have a week to start and spread your own social media platform. Tell me about it. Invite me to be part of it. And then that's where the questions will come next week. But if not, the artist formerly known as Twitter is still the only game in town. He's the awful one. I'm staying put. All right?
Why should I change my name?
Precisely.
As social media editor, I don't want to talk about it.
I'm at Chris Hewitt on Twitter. Slide into my DMs if you can. Reply to any of my tweets or seats if you can. All right, should we get into movie news?
Sure. Should be a quick one.
Strike still happening?
Strike is still happening.
AMPTP
is still not holding talks, as far as I know, with either guild.
They'll start turning on themselves.
I mean, honestly, that would be okay with me at this point. Mm. What has happened sometimes in previous strikes has been that the studios made individual arrangements one by one until the strike essentially broke down and AMPTP, or its equivalent at the time, made a deal in the end. So, I don't know. Public opinion, I feel like, is very one-sided on this. Obviously, our opinion is not much of a mystery.
We're a bunch of pinko lefty commies.
That's it. And
are you not a member of the Communist Party?
But it has been interesting. You know, there have been some barnstorming speeches given by some of the sort of stars of the guilds.
Bryan Cranston.
Bryan Cranston.
But he is a really good example because he is a guy whose sort of fame, if you like, came very late in life. Was a working actor for something like 20 years before he became a series regular. Who knows exactly what it's like to have these struggles and is now in a position where he has a big enough megaphone, as it were, to draw attention to it. Steady. We've also had stuntmen or stunt people setting themselves on fire on the lines, which has been very entertaining. Everyone seems to be fine, don't worry, and not in a sort of protesting the war kind of a sense. A lot more sort of actors and so on out this week protesting and walking the line. I learned, and I told you this yesterday, Chris, but you knew it already, but Rosemary Harris of Spider-Man fame.
I believe there's a hero in all of us.
Is Jennifer Ely's mum, as in Pride and Prejudice, as in the definitive Lizzie Bennet.
Didn't know that.
I mean, if I knew that, I had forgotten, but it certainly had not registered in my head.
I didn't know.
Anyway, I know this because Rosemary Harris, at the age of 95, was out picketing.
Well, there was a rally in London, wasn't there, in Leicester Square, where... Is it Equity, the sort of SAG equivalent over here? So lots of British actors showing solidarity. I saw Brian Cox was talking at that.
Oh, fuck off, he probably said. Fuck off.
Yeah, fuming.
Love him.
I also saw clips of Andy Serkis talking, and he's an interesting one to talk to because he's someone who's obviously had his likeness captured a lot and edited and adjusted on both sides, in front of the camera and behind.
How can you be sure that was Andy Serkis?
Could have been Ben Mendelsohn. That lady will never know.
Ken Mendelsohn. Ken Kendelsohn.
Yeah.
I Barbenheimer myself. What can I say?
He's glitching. Yeah, it's fascinating. Am I right in thinking that A24 is kind of...
So they have carved out an exception for some indie films, and I think indie studio, essentially studios.
There are 67 waivers, 67 waivers, 67 productions in the States right now apparently have waivers. Now, these are truly independent productions. Yep. That's why they've been given waivers. They're not affiliated with any studios at this point in time.
And they have also, you know, promised to abide by certain terms, which is... led to these waivers being applied. So it's very much not a carving out exception so much as it is essentially winning vis-a-vis those productions.
Yes.
It's starting to have an effect on release dates now. There was rumours of June moving back. I'm not sure if it's been 100% confirmed yet.
I think Challengers wasn't on the Venice Film Festival, and there's...
That's the Luca Guadagnino
tennis drama, yeah.
Right, yep.
So... I don't know. That seems to be being pushed back as well. And of course, this is all seems very much like a case of Hollywood shooting itself in the foot because Barbenheimer had an incredible record-breaking weekend at the box office last week. And, you know, we've talked about some of the bigger movies that have done okay, but maybe not done as well as anticipated. Dial of Destiny, even Mission Impossible Dead Reckoning Part 1 hasn't done what I think they expected it to do at the box office, which is frankly barmy to me.
What it should do in a just and equitable
universe. World. I think studios are now going to have to, if they are moving forward, but they're going to have to maybe look at budgets, and they're going to have to look at things. I mean, I know COVID is its own thing, but they're maybe going to have to look at budgets and revise their expectations downwards. So I think we've got to a point where people were almost thinking that $1 billion was the new $100 million, and it was just a cinch to get to a billion. There's been $1 billion movie this year so far, and it's a Super Mario Brothers movie. Now, whether Barbie gets there, because it's done incredibly well in opening weekend,
it's looking good.
Shall see. It's looking good, but you never know. But it probably will get there. But the billion isn't the guarantee it once was pre-COVID, which is a ludicrous sentence to say, $1 billion will get you Kylian Mbappe services for a year. It seems, but it ain't easy for a film to attain. It's just, it's bizarre. But anyway, so what I'm saying is that Barbenheimer did incredibly well. Oppenheimer made over $80 million at the in its opening weekend, which is astonishing for a three-hour movie that is pretty much a bunch of people talking in rooms for 3 hours. Yep. Barbie made over $150 million in its opening weekend.
US
These are US figures, of course. And, you know, and that's a record in so many ways, and so many records were broken as a result. It was the biggest 1-2 punch ever, I think.
Was it the biggest opening weekend for a female director?
Biggest opening weekend for a female director. All of these things, all these records were being broken. People are going to the cinema in droves. You know, yes, we were comedically griping about people sitting next to us. How fucking dare they in Barbenheimer? But the fact is, that cinema was pretty busy at 11:30 on a Tuesday night. Yeah. And trying, you know, I hadn't seen Barbie or Oppenheimer, and I was looking, I was thinking about just popping along at the weekend, and I looked at my local picture house, and I looked at my local Odeon, and I was like, oh, I am not just popping along because there is nothing.
No seats.
All the seats, all the good seats are gone in all the IMAX screens. Barbie is just sold out. Oppenheimer is sold out. That has a little bit of an effect, a little bit of spillover effect into the likes of Mission and Dial of Destiny, but not a huge effect. But the fact is that people are going to the cinema now. They're energized. They're excited. Mm. They're dressing up. You know, I saw ladies get off the bus the other day all dressed in pink, and they were clearly excited about going to see Oppenheimer. So, well done to them. But people are galvanized, right? And we've been talking about disappointing box office all summer long, and now we have this situation where the box office looks like it's pointing upwards again, and then the studios are going, yeah, no, we're actually going to not come to the negotiating table. We're not going to settle this strike, because we could. We absolutely could. We have it in our power. We could do it in the stroke of a pen, the push of a button. We could absolutely do it. We could meet your demands and not lose a bead of sweat. But they're not doing it, because awful people. But they're not doing it, which is a real shame.
And what's weird is now Wall Street is actually turning against the studios. I think that's been the fear for the studios.
There were
Wall Street analysts and investors speaking out along the lines of settle this. This is crazy. Because you now have a situation where, for example, one of the films that they're looking at pushing back to next year is Disney Animation's Wish. And Wish it has been specifically designed as a 100-year celebration of Disney Animation, Disney Studios. So it's the 100th anniversary of the founding of Disney this year. And literally this film is all about wishing upon a star and all these kind of Disney tropes. And they have built in references to all sorts of Disney movies of the past, you know, sort of woven into the fabric of this thing. But also it's an original story. It's a new fantasy, blah, blah, blah. And they're looking at pushing that back to next year because of this strike. That is crazed.
That's cray cray.
It is cray cray.
That's totes cray cray.
It has been specifically designed for this release date, for this Thanksgiving in the US.
That is demented. And they're damaging cinemas.
They're damaging cinema
chains,
yeah.
And here and there are on the verge of closing, and they're taking the product away from them.
And they were trying to get cinema operators to intervene with SAG, etc., and say, you need to stop striking. And, you know, the answer is not SAG needs to stop striking. It's like you need to take these requests, these very reasonable requests for things like breaks for young people, seriously, and not just say no to everything. It's a mess. It's an absolute mess. But yeah, hopefully the pressure of literally the entire world will make a difference. Anyway, there was, I mean, a little bit of other movie news, I guess.
Ugh.
You mentioned Venice, so they have announced the lineup. And what they've kind of gone for is, like, there have been a lot of worries about what are the autumn festivals going to do, because this strike is expected to go for another couple of months, right? So what do you do if you're planning Venice, if you're planning Toronto, and you're suddenly not going to have all this star power getting out of little, you know, motor launches and you know, striding up into the festival hall? And the answer is you get star directors. Seems to be the plan. So there are going to be a lot of big names headed to Venice. Ridley Scott apparently is bringing Napoleon. Denis Villeneuve is currently due to bring Dune Part 2 and Martin Scorsese, obviously, Killers of the Flower Moon. David Fincher is going to be back with The Killer, which is the Michael Fassbender film with Tilda Swinton and so on.
It's mm-hmm. very exciting.
Very exciting. Ava DuVernay with Origin. Mm. Wes Anderson with, I think it's a short film, The Wonderful Story of Henry Sugar. Sofia Coppola's Priscilla, Michael Mann's Ferrari, Bradley Cooper's Maestro. You've got William Friedkin, Harmony Korine.
Wow.
Jay Bayona, Richard Linklater, Yorgos Lanthimos, Jesus. Pablo Larraine.
What a lineup.
And then some other people. That is a heck of a lineup of directors, because that's the only people currently that they're going to have to walk the carpet.
Are they going to fight Ethan Hunt in a disco?
It's going to be interesting, isn't it? Also, like, what do you do if you're Bradley Cooper? Can you answer questions about directing but not about your performance? Like, how does that work? It's going to be really, really an interesting line to walk there.
Will he be there? I mean,
it's a good question.
It's hard to know.
So yeah, anyway, but at the moment, as things stand, they are planning, obviously, to go ahead with Venice. So, you know.
Yeah, it's just crazy. Exciting. Again, this is an industry that's just recovering. It's teetering after COVID. Why push it down again?
Why push it down again? Well, we are still getting some films coming out. So there was a trailer yesterday for The Exorcist Believer.
I'm a believer.
Your mother bakes cakes and all.
Are you sure? That's the line. So this is the David Gordon Green sequel to The Exorcist.
Yes.
50 years on.
Yeah, that's mad, isn't it?
It's crazy.
And Ellen Burstyn is in it.
That is exciting. That is very exciting.
She's in it. She has avoided all the previous Exorcist sequels and prequels and reboots and TV shows. But this is the one that they managed to pay her. This is the one that they managed to pay her respect. Enough respect. And her character, Chris McNeil, enough respect that she came back and did this. I've spoken to David Gordon Green about this movie. He's been talking a good talk.
You know,
but he also did that for Halloween Kills, and look where we got it. Look where that got us. But
good
I will
trailer,
say,
though, I thought.
Halloween Ends, I thought was terrific. I'm going to say it again. I'm going to go on the record. I thought it was the best of the trilogy. Halloween Ends.
Okay.
Really good. Really interesting. And if you know, it didn't just retread the original Halloween. And I get the sense that he's trying not to retread The Exorcist here. I mean, how can you, right?
Not quite.
But the interesting thing about The Exorcist franchise, such as it is over the years, is that, you know, whenever they do make an Exorcist, for the most part, it's actually really interesting. Exorcist 2, the Heretic, the John Boorman sequel, is awful, but in the sense that you cannot, it's some wild swings in there, and you cannot tear your eyes away from it. William Peter Blatty's Exorcist 3 is terrific. You know, until they had a studio mandated exorcism in at the end, because they were like,
"You are going to have some exorcism in your exorcist movie."
And probably the less said about the Paul Schrader, Rennie Harlin, Dominion exorcist prequel to Kerfuffle, the better. But still, Schrader's and the Pope's exorcist, which is the best of them all, quite frankly. And if you don't like that, then take it up with my boss, the Pope.
Your boss.
My boss. Yeah.
I've been telling Northern Ireland on you.
Chris I've been is undercover. The Pope's
undercover Pope. That's an amazing.
Undercover Pope.
The Pope goes undercover in the Orange Order.
Are you sure?
Yes.
I'm not sure.
I think that's a good one.
I have some notes, but cool, I guess. I mean, I like the title. Let's workshop it.
Davy, do you want a pint? I am not the Pope. Really? Oh, that sounds like something like the Pope would say if they were trying to allay suspicion. Listen, we'll workshop the dialogue.
I think
basically I have the rough idea. Oh no, what a mistake in Jamaica, says the Pope. Anyway, there's an idea. Take it up, mommy boss, Pazuzu.
Mm-hmm.
Now, David Gordon Green, is he trying to break down up?
It might be by now.
Okay. So I spoke to him for a trailer breakdown, and he said that the demon in this is not Pazuzu. Pazuzu! who, of course, was the demon of the first movie.
Mm.
Oh!
That's a shame, because Ben used a great line in the news story for the trailer, which was, when they come back from the forest, they're Pazuzu'd up the wazoo.
Up the wazoo. See,
wow. Oh, yeah.
He did let it slip, actually, there, didn't he?
Yeah, this is why Ben fails.
Oh.
But you know, it's fine. He'll listen to this and go, damn it. But this looks interesting. So this is The Exorcist Believer. Ellen Burstyn is back as Chris McNeil. There are rumors that Linda Blair might appear as Regan McNeil at some point. She was certainly on set because David Gordon Green told me that he basically hired her as a demon performance advisor to the two young actresses who are in the movie. Mercedes McCambridge obviously is no longer with us, and the legendary makeup effects guru Dick Smith is no longer with us either. But it looks interesting, and he's approaching it from this kind of philosophical, spiritual point of view, much like Friedkin did with the original movie. It's two young girls who are possessed this time rather than one young girl, and they have two families, both of whom have different approaches to religion and different approaches to spirituality. Neither of them are Catholic, so it's about trying to find, how do you find an exorcist and an exorcism in a situation like that where you can't quite agree on which approach to take and which religion to hang your flag on, so to speak. Looks interesting, you know, but the problem is, since Friedkin broke all that new ground in 1972 or three, I want to say three.
This will be 50 years.
It is 50 years, absolutely right. Yeah. 73. Maybe they should push that back. So it's celebrating the 51st anniversary. So 73, Friedkin, you know, breaks all that new ground in 1973. And since then, I don't know that the exorcism subgenre has necessarily done anything new or interesting. Now and again, there'll be one that smashes out of the park, like Scott Derrickson's The Exorcism of Emily Rose.
Creepy film.
Fuck me. But subtext, fuck me. Chris Hewitt, Empire. But I don't know. It all seems sometimes a little bit been there, done that, got the possessed t-shirt. What do you guys think? I've been talking far too long about this.
No, I think that's true. I mean, I like individual exorcism scenes sometimes, like Constantine actually had quite a cool
one. Yeah.
With the mirror above the bed. Yeah. Remember that? That was really cool. And so there have been like moments like that that were quite visually cool or interesting. Obviously, you know, stuff like Supernatural has done it to death. Like every possible variation on exorcism has at some point been done in Supernatural, let me assure you of that.
Did their nipples get possessed?
Okay, not every possible one. All right, what would a possessed nipple do? Like,
never ask me that question, Helen.
I really regret it.
It's a leading question.
Once again, and I really cannot stress this enough, they have their shirts on for entire seasons at a time.
Yes, but what I'm proposing is Supernatural season 16, in which
I'm listening.
Dean and Sam's nipples get possessed.
Nope.
They meet the Pope, who is undercover in the Orange Order.
And is also Russell Crowe.
Can I remind you of almost every time that an American network TV show has gone to Northern Ireland and what it looked like? And can I suggest to you that we don't do that?
The atrocities inflicted upon the Northern Irish people.
By network TV. Are worse than the atrocities inflicted on Northern Irish people by the Northern Irish people. So really, like, I don't know if you, in Alias, right, the globetrotting spy show, there was one time where she had to go to Cork and they bring up a sort of establishing shot of Cork and it says Cork on it, right? And Cork is like the second biggest city in Ireland.
It is. I have family that live in Cork. I've been there many times.
It's the biggest laundry department in Ireland.
The picture they showed was of a small fishing village.
Oh. No.
In fairness, Cork is a small fish.
I mean, in fairness,
it's not a huge city.
It's not a huge city, and it is on the coast, so they've got that right.
Yeah.
Everything else, though.
There's lots of nice stuff in Cork.
Lots of nice stuff in Cork. Mm. Go visit Cork, everybody. Yep, it's nice.
That's a message.
Are you sponsored by the Tourism Ireland Board?
Well, I am going to Northern Ireland next week, so.
Are you?
I am, yeah.
How long?
I told you, I'm going away next week.
For how long?
Friday to Friday. A week.
Oh, a week. Okay. I'm going back to Northern Ireland for most of August.
There you go. It's a place to be.
I'll be there for the 15th.
I'm not going to Northern Ireland.
Oh, missing out.
You are missing out. It's the crack is mighty. Yeah. Love a bit of crack.
Anyway, as you can tell, there's not a lot of
other. No, there is. There's the Marvels.
There was a Marvels trailer.
The Marvels.
Yeah. I'm marvelous.
Yeah. Now, in fairness, I don't know whether I haven't seen Secret Invasion, the final episode of Secret Invasion at time of recording. I'm having to gird my loins and take a long run up to that one. I saw it was 37 minutes, the finale.
Yeah, it's pacey.
It's pacey. Oh!
Not in a Dawson's Creek. Like, no. That would be a real turn up for the boat.
That honestly would have been an improvement.
See a scroll as well the whole time.
Joshua Jackson turning up would have been kind of amazing, don't you think?
I would be. That is his name, isn't it? Why isn't he in the Marvel universe? I think he'd be good. I don't know.
Did you know that because of LDG, Little Drinking Game, I have been experiencing a smattering of kids TV shows recently.
Sure.
One of the kids TV shows we've been experiencing is a thing called Vampirina. Now, I have notes about all these things, but Vampirina is about a vampire family who relocate from Transylvania to a human neighborhood and then try and blend in despite being obviously vampires.
Okay.
And James Vanderbeek voices the dad.
Oh, fair play.
Yeah.
Well done, him.
Yeah, Dawson's Coffin Dawson. Creek.
Very good.
It's a good joke. Thank you. Thank you. Anyway, let's pick up the pacey. What were we talking about? The Marvels.
The Marvels.
So Secret Invasion's a load of shit, but hopefully the Marvels won't be. And I don't know whether... Nail my colours to the master. Which is the phrase I was looking for earlier on. Go, nail your flag to the pole. Nail your colours to the mast, you idiot. Secret Invasion is a disappointment, shall we say, but the final episode might bring it back in 37 brisk minutes. Who knows? We shall find out. But I don't know yet whether The Marvels is a prequel or a sequel to that show.
I think it's a sequel without giving away any spoilers for Secret
Interesting.
Invasion.
Interesting. Okay. Interesting.
Yeah, because Nick Fury is obviously in it.
Yes. Okay.
Which is also not a spoiler for Secret Invasion. That made it sound like he dies. And,
right.
Or doesn't die. Anyway.
No.
Yeah.
That's fine. Fun trailer.
Fun trailer.
Yeah, the first one was fun.
Yep.
I think the central concept of them all swapping bodies and swapping places is a really fun one. It doesn't give a huge amount of clue about what the actual plot is. You get a better look at Zoe Ashton as the villain.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
She looks bit cool. A little bit more action, I would say, this time than before.
There's a nice shot at the end of them all three of them fighting with her. But it doesn't give a ton away.
So it seems to be that she is a Kree.
Mm-hmm.
Feels like she's a Kree who has beef with Carol Danvers. In fact, her name even sounds a bit like Danvers, doesn't it? Let me just see. Hang on. Yes, she plays Dar-Ben, which actually sounds nothing like Danvers. Ignore me. But that's who Zoe Ashton plays. And a female villain, of course, Nia DaCosta co-wrote and then directed this movie.
Mm.
It does look like a lot of fun, but she seems to have beef with Carol Danvers. She says, Sophie, what's the line?
You took everything from me.
Which indicates like that Carol Danvers has become some sort of intergalactic bailiff in the years
I mean,
in between.
Yeah, she's been up to something and we're not sure what.
She's
could be that.
So, and she does something with
the light bracelet.
That
Kamala Khan has.
Yeah.
So she uses that to somehow do a bit of jiggery-pokery that means that all, which is, I guess, makes sense. So all the people who have these kind of light powers, so Photon, Monica Rambeau, played by Teyonah Parris, who was introduced in WandaVision, and obviously Kamala Khan, played by Iman Vellani, and Carol Danvers, played by Brie Larson. Every time they use their powers, they switch places with each other, no matter where they are in the galaxy, which is interesting. Helen has notes about the science, but we'll get to that.
No, this is fine. A wizard did it and ran away. Like, that kind of science, I'm okay with.
This is what you're fine with?
Yeah.
This is what you're fine with?
Quantum entanglement, dude. It's fine.
But heaven forfend someone go to one place in London and then pop up in another place in London that is not too far away from the other place in London.
Look, there was a great Terry Pratchett quote about this that I'm about to misquote, but it was something along the lines of you can be vague about the route to the mountains of dreams, but you have to know the way to the post office. Like you can be vague about the magical bangles, like shift your place wherever you are in the universe. But you have to know your way to Greenwich from Charing Cross.
You do, but, you know, that's unforgivable. But, you know, filming permits and all that sort of stuff. Anyway, looks like fun. There's a couple of shots that look a little bit, you know, CG heavy. They're quite obviously green screeny, compositely backgroundy. But apart from that, it looks fun.
There was a shot of lots of baby kittens floating around.
Lots
baby flurkins.
Flying flurkins.
Flurkins
all over the shop. Is this the last trailer of the Marvels?
I kind of hope so in a way. You know, because you don't want to see half the movie before you go in, do you? So I wouldn't be too mad if it is the last one. Certainly the last big one. You can have a couple of re-edits as TV spots or whatever. Mm. That's fine.
And I presume Ben Shapiro's done a tight 37 minutes on this trailer, has he?
Ben Shapiro destroys the Marvel's trailer for 37 minutes. Arr, women!
There you
You'd
go.
Be surprised at the amount of seconds. People who do still, like, in our comments, just spewing crap.
Spewing crap.
Just at the fact that it's three women fronting it.
They feel it's so important to let you know that they're not interested in it.
And yeah. Like, you're taking super important.
You're taking the time out of your day to tell us you're not interested in it.
Not interested, don't care.
How disengaged can you be?
Very disengaged. But listen, I am an ally. I am a feminist. I am the son of a mother and the mother of a daughter. And
I am the nephew to a female aunt.
Yes.
I am the son of a motherless goat. I am all of these things. I am very, very, I'm excited about the Marvels. And there you go. That's the end of that sentence. Right. Okay. Anything else?
That's pretty much all I saw.
Really? Is that it? There's been no casting news because how could there be?
No, pretty much not.
If you're a studio head and you're listening to this, then please do talk to the SAG, talk to the Guga, Wooga, the WGA, talk to them and resolve the strike so we have some movie news to talk about. Although, in fairness, we did about 20 minutes there, so that's not bad. All right, a couple of quick plugs. One, if you are listening to this on Friday, July 28th, and you're in London and you're at a loss for something to do, there may well still be tickets available for the live spoiler special interview with Christopher McQuarrie that is taking place at King's Place tonight, July 28th, one night only. 7 p.m. Spiritual Home. It's going to be incredible. And it is a culmination of our epic sit downs on this movie. Part one, by the way, part one of the Mission Impossible Dead Reckoning spoiler special interviews with Christopher McQuarrie is now up, all 3.5 hours of it. It will soon be followed by part two, which is a mere sprightly 2 hours and 15 minutes. And then on Friday, which is one of the reasons why we're doing this a little bit early, on Friday, he and I will be sitting down for another full day to talk about Mission Impossible Dead Reckoning Part 1, and then we'll be going straight to King's Place and talking about it some more. At which point, I expect him to fully just shake my hand and go, I hope to never see you again.
There are no more words.
Yes, please do not darken my door ever, ever again. It's going to be incredible. There are still a couple of tickets at time of recording available. Go to kingsplace.uk and search for Empire or Chris McQuarrie or Mission, and it'll come up. The URL is far too complicated to go into here, but check them out. £12.50 if you want to hear some incredible anecdotes from, frankly, the best storyteller I've ever heard, then come along Friday night. It's going to be amazing. And if not, and you just want to hear the spoiler specials, then subscribe now. empire.supportingcast.fm or supportingcast.empire.fm. It's one of the two. What do you want from me? Preparation? Professionalism? I think we're well past that by now. Anything else? Oh, live shows. Yep. I guess Helen James isn't here this week, so we should mention that Pilot has a live show.
On August the 19th of August.
19th of August.
It's our 250th episode.
It is.
Bless their little cotton socks.
How did they get that? Yes, well done them. And that's also at King's Place, which is our spiritual home, not their spiritual home. They're trying to claim it from us. No. Yeah, be
Look,
good.
They're just
be good,
like the Airbnb guests.
Yes, that's what it is. Yeah.
Who come in now and again.
Yeah, you know what? Buy a ticket. Go on.
Go on.
And then we're doing a live show at the London Podcast Festival. Well, actually, we're doing two live shows. So we're doing one live show on September 9th. We are the headline act.
Thank you very much.
On Saturday, September 9th at the London Podcast Festival, King's Place. And it's going to be really fun. It's going to be a bespoke show. It's going to be a one-off show. We're hoping to get to the point soon where we can actually activate streaming passes for people who can't make it to London. Ticket sales are going pretty well, but could do better. And if you want to be able to stream it, then hopefully we can get to that point pretty soon. So kingsplace.co.uk for that. And then, this is interesting, we've never done this before, on September 14th, in the evening of September 14th, Helen's looking at me quizzically, but you definitely do know about this because I've told you many, many times.
Okay.
We are doing a team up a mashup.
Oh, yes, I do know
a crossover. Yeah. And I have no idea how this is going to work. I don't think they know either, but frankly, we're going to have fun finding out with the podcast, the hit podcast, Drunk Women Solving Crimes. So it's going to be a Drunk Women Solving Empire, essentially. I guess we'll be solving crimes together. I don't know. Here's the slight fly in their ointment, the spanner in their works. It's going to be me, Helen, and James. None of us drink.
No one drinks.
Drunk women and sober women and sober men solving crimes.
Drunk women and teetotal twats.
Okay, is it that woman from your Oppenheimer screening?
Yeah, I'll stagger.
What's this about?
That's what instead of getting drunk, I'll just watch Barbie and Oppenheimer again and then stagger straight there with my mind gone. My synapse is fried. So that's available as well. And that is also on kingspice.co.uk.
Boom.
My God, there's a lot of stuff.
Plugs, so plugs. Stuff.
Plugs, plugs, plugs. Closing up the plug bag. All right. Who wants a guest?
Yes, please.
Me.
Sophie, you're interviewing said guest. So set him up.
Okay. So this is Danny Philippou, one of the directors of the new horror film Talk To Me that's out this week. He's a co-director. He directed it with his twin brother, Michael Philippou, who can't talk to us today. So I'm just talking to Danny. And it's a great new horror. We're going to review it later. I haven't done the interview yet, so I don't know what we're going to say, but I'm sure it'll be great. Enjoy.
Here's Danny Philippou. Enjoy.
We're delighted to welcome to the Empire podcast today, Danny Philippou, co-director of Talk To Me. Danny, how's your day going so far?
It's all going awesome. Very excited to talk to you.
I'm excited to talk to you too. Congratulations on the film. I absolutely loved it. I know that you and Michael have been making movies since you were kids. I mean, just to like take stock for a second, how does it feel now to be sort of days away from your feature debut being released into the world? Have you had a chance to kind of savor that moment and enjoy it?
We've been doing a lot of traveling around and a lot of press and stuff. And it feels like when we shot the film and released it, like the first screening was in October last year. So it feels like it's been like on pause or something. And then so we're about to press resume and now it's about to go out globally. It's very exciting and nerve-wracking, and I'm so curious to see how it all happens, and we've never experienced this side of filmmaking. Like the producers and that are talking about sending over these box office reports and so that's insane to me and new to me, and very nerve-wracking, but so exciting, and it still feels so surreal. Like, even walking into a cinema and seeing my poster on the wall for our film is the craziest feeling ever. It's incredible. It's so exciting.
I bet. And it's going big, right? I mean, I saw it here in the UK. It's been distributed by Altitude over here. Yeah. And when they introduced the film at the screening, they said it was like their biggest distribution plan that they've got, I think. Like they're really, really pushing it hard. So it must feel good to know that lots of people are going to get to see it.
Yeah. And it was so awesome to go to London, and that cinema, I think it's called the Music Box Theatre in London. I think that's what it's called. The London screening had the best sound in the world. Like, I cannot believe how good that sound was. Mm-hmm. It blew my mind. Like, even the smallest little touches that we put in the surround sound, you heard everything. So me and Michael loved those screenings in London and UK, and the audiences there were amazing, and Altitude have been so generous. So we loved our time in London.
Oh, amazing. I mean, you and Michael made a name for yourselves via YouTube, where you posted for years. You really honed these skills in terms of comedy, horror, stunts, special effects, all of it. Going into directing this feature, what stuff did you find that you kind of carried over with you from YouTube? And what were some of the new things you learned, or what came as a surprise?
Yeah. We were able to bring even our makeup artist, Beck Barado, who did all of our Raka Raka stuff for free. Like, she would constantly just be helping us because we never had the money to really like spend like that, but she just wanted to be involved. So we were able to bring her over and have her be a head of department on makeup on Talk To Me, which was so amazing. Having her on set and having that familiar presence was really nice. We did so much work on the practical side. So we were able to be really hands-on with a makeup artist with our prosthetics team to really break down what we wanted and collaborate with them to help bring the spirits and the violence to life.
Yeah.
But what came as a surprise was the music. And we learnt in this process that we want to work with a composer way earlier, like in pre-production or even when we're writing the script, to send that to them and start having music composed while in that stage. Because I think that it being slapped on at the end, we didn't have enough time to... We actually did get there in the end, thank God, but we were right up against the wall of trying to get the music right. And Mark is very specific with sound and music. And to have that be ingrained in the bones of the script, I think will be a very helpful tool moving forward.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, I was going to come onto this later, but I really loved the soundtrack, and it felt like you were using, I'm not familiar with it, but a lot of like Aussie artists, it felt like anyway, yeah. Which really helped like ground the film in Australia. I mean, were you thinking about that sort of stuff earlier on as well? Or was that kind of all stuff that you learned, the soundtrack and the score, did you sort of realize as you went along?
Well, yeah, we were really heavily thinking about the soundtrack in pre-production, and even to have Sia, who's a South Australian artist, featured in a film was amazing. And she, gave it to us for a quarter of the price because we were South Australian. So we were able to get that for a lot cheaper than it normally would cost. And it's awesome being able to put the spotlight on some smaller artists as well. Like, there's an amazing artist named Takara. We love her so much. She's from Australia, and we were able to integrate her music into the film as well. And there was a bunch of like upcoming artists that were able to put a spotlight on, which was really, really amazing.
Oh, great. To go back to the beginning a little bit, I know that Talk To Me started life as an idea from Daley Pearson, who we know from the MCU as well as creating shows like Bluey. So that's kind of wild that he's gone from a kids animated show to a horror film. We spoke to him for the mag a few issues ago as well. Just can you tell us how that all sort of came about, really, how that process started?
Yeah. Well, we just met Daley years ago and just connected with him. And he was a producer and he was a director. And we just became really good friends. And he sent me this script, which was more of a comedy film to begin with. It was a sort of a horror comedy about these kids having fun with possession. And I personally had an experience where these neighbors that we watched grow up, one of them was experimenting with drugs for the first time. And he was on the floor convulsing, and all the kids that he was with weren't helping him. They were just filming him and laughing at him. So I remember seeing that footage and it really bothering me and sticking with me. And so there was that experience, and there was these characters that I was working on in another thing, which was Mir and the Jade and the Riley. And then Daley's short film about these kids having fun with possession, it just all came together, and there was like a flow. And once I did a rewrite, made it a bit more serious. Once I started writing, I couldn't stop. And my amazing collaborator, Bill Hinsman, who I co-wrote the script with, were able to find a hand in the second draft of the film and start bringing it all to life. So the writing process is so much fun as well to explore that.
Yeah, of course. And I know that, so you worked on the screenplay, whereas Michael didn't. What is it for you about writing that you really enjoy as opposed to directing, and why you want to get involved in that side of things?
It's very therapeutic to write, and you can express yourself really personally, and you can, and it's a process that I just couldn't do with Michael because it's my brother, and it's just too awkward. Like, I feel like we'd just be at each other's throats the whole time. So I definitely couldn't write it with Michael, but Michael was really good at giving me really brutal notes. So I would send him a script. Yeah. And he'll be like, boring, lame, what is that? Like, he'll be like really like that. But you need someone that you can trust and that you know isn't just saying that to say it. It's like some people are trying to be too nurturing when they're giving notes, or they're scared to be too mean. So it's good to have someone like your brother to just punch holes in the script.
Tell you it like it is. Something I wanted to talk about was the opening sequence, because it really hits you over the face. It's so great. It's such a great start. It's got such energy. It's this long take. It ends with a really shocking moment that really lets you know what you're in for. What went into devising that opening sequence? How did you know that that's how you wanted to start the film?
Well, I knew that throughout the film, there's these party sequences, and it's sort of the hand is a bit like a representation of vices. And like, so if we're going to use the drug or alcohol analogy, that those parties start really grand and then slowly dwindle and get smaller in size. And I knew I wanted to have an opening that from the outside pulls our audience into the world of this film and into the horror. And there's so many subtextual things that are going on there with the door and then the characters and what's being said. And with the phones and the cameras, and I just knew we wanted to, pull the audience in and show them the consequences that could happen to our main characters with what they're messing with. Also, it was the last thing that we shot because we had to really build up to that because there were hundreds and hundreds of extras there, and it was one take, and it was 3 a.m. in the morning, and it was, but because it was a wrapping shot, that fake party turned into a real party. Like, as soon as it was like, like an explosion. And also another fun thing about that opening sequence is that all the main actors, like Mia and Jade and Riley, they're all in that sequence dressed up as different characters. And they're throughout the frame. So you can spot them if you look really carefully. It's like, where's one?
A little Easter egg when you go back and rewatch it, see if you can find them.
See if you can find them. Yeah, it's difficult, but they're on camera. You can see them. It was fun.
Amazing. It makes sense, I guess, because it is an ambitious like sequence. So did you feel like if you'd had to tackle that at the beginning of the shoot, would that have been like quite daunting? Did it feel like you'd built up your skills throughout the shoot and then you could take that on at the end?
Yeah, and another main thing actually was that COVID was over, but it was starting to slowly ramp up again in Australia. Mm. And they were very strict on those sort of things. So if we did that earlier on in the shoot, I feel like we could have lost crew members to COVID, and then, you know, which we did throughout the process. Like, we were starting to lose crew members, and it was sort of like Survivor a little bit with people that were able to come to work and able to not, and everyone was wearing their masks, and it was a bit of social distancing. Again, this wasn't in the peak of the pandemic at all. It was over, but then there was a small potential ramp up again. So it was that was another stressor and another reason that we'd shot it last. But yeah, there was another one taker in the film, one shot that's like down a hospital corridor that's towards the end of the film, and that was harder to get than the party sequence, and that scared us. We were so scared of doing like a big one shot because that was so hard to nail. But we got there in the end.
You did. And when it comes to the actual possession scenes with the hand and the kids and the party and everything, they're so effective and creepy, and they've got a really distinct look and feel to them. Like, even just the visual of them holding the hand and the black eyes, the big black eyes, I think those scenes are part of what makes the film so memorable. What went into you guys figuring out what you wanted those scenes to look like the identifying parts of the film, if you know what I mean?
Yeah. Well, a very big part was the sound design of those sequences. And there's hints about how some of those spirits died with the sound design as well that we're able to do. And there's reoccurring ghosts that are inside Mia for the film that we also convey with the sound. So there's a lot of water and echoes, and there's like a lot of stuff happening in the music as well that are tying different things together. And we knew that we wanted the camera to feel a bit like astral projection and be a bit tied to the spirit. So that camera is sort of being controlled by the movements of the spirit and what they're doing in the room. So that was another fun part that we were able to really beat out in our pre-production and, you know, pre-shoot all of our iPhone and really start putting that together. And the makeup effects with our Beck Barato, like finding that look was very exciting as well. And the first person that we actually shot possessed was my sister. And she was just in at the start of the film, they're looking at a possession on a phone. And that's my sister.
Yeah.
And that was when we were able to like just do a really quick scene and just try and find that look. So pre-production was so much fun on the film. It was amazing.
Yeah, and it really ties into it because the kids are all filming stuff on their phone. So I guess you testing it out a bit more lo-fi really helps sort of hone that part of the film as well.
Yeah. And then also even with the social media aspect, we really wanted it to come across as realistic. And even before pre-production even started, like months and months before, we were fighting to get the rights of Snapchat so we could hide that. And I was hitting up the Sidemen. I'm friends with the Sidemen. So I was like hitting up KSI and all that. I'm like, oh, can I please use one of your clips of the movie? Because my neighbor's name is Riley, who the character Riley is based on. And he would always go to sleep just watching the Sidemen. So we wanted to have that in the film as well.
And I mean, you mentioned Riley. I mean, him, Jade, Mia, played by Sophie Wilde. This is a great young cast for most of them. I'm guessing this is kind of a breakout role, and they're so great. Can you talk about the casting process and finding those guys and what helped you settle on this group?
Yeah. It was such a crazy task. We took 2 years to cast the film to find everyone. That was due to that. That's when the pandemic did hit at the start of that, so it delayed the process. But we were able to really, really search through everyone and make sure that we found the right people. And once we saw those auditions for those main actors, like, we knew that they were it straight away. And it was even to the point I was that connected and in love with the people that we were casting, that Zoe, who plays Haley, even though they're not a main character, I was not going to shoot the film unless they were available, because I just knew they were so perfect for the role. And even someone like Sophie wasn't a name, so we lost $1 million out of the budget just by casting her, because she wasn't a draw at the time. Mm. And they're like, oh, she's not a star. But we're like, but she's going to be. Like, auditions, man, she's the greatest performer in the world. I cannot believe the stuff that she was sending through. We knew that she could carry the film. And part of the thing that I'm the most proud of for this film is to be able to present Sophie to the world. And even if the film and the directing is terrible, like, her performance isn't. And that's, I do not think that's up for debate. If you watch that, you can't say she gives a bad performance. And to have people like Jordan Peele text me and FaceTime me and talk to me about Sophie's performance and her character, man, it means so much to me. Like, I think that she's going to go on to do massive things. And I'm so proud of helping bring her to the world. We love her so much.
One of the things that made the film really land for me was that there is an emotional core running through it. Mia's dealing with a lot of grief and loneliness. She's lost her mum, and that ties the film together so well. Was that emotion something you were keen to have in there and balance alongside the horror, but also the comedy? Because there are laughs in this film as well. There's really funny moments. So were you keen to kind of balance all of those things?
Yeah, there's an amazing film called Memories of Murder by director Bong Joon-ho. And he's really able to, like, merge tones pretty seamlessly. And they can have these really heightened comedy beats while also being super serious the minute before. So we're super inspired by the way that he was able to balance tone. So we weren't afraid, because life is never one emotion. It's never one beat. There's always so much things that are happening. Like, I think that sort of we had in this film, I had a friend who Jade is based on, whose ringtone is the crazy frog.
Frog. I loved that.
And we were at a funeral, and then her phone went off, and sounds started playing. I just remember that moment. So we sort of have that in like a serious moment in the film as well. Balancing the tone was a really important thing to me. And having those characters be really grounded and rooted and feel real and have those problems. We have mental illness in our family, and we had a suicide in the family as well. And our grandfather was helping raise us when we were kids, and when we were 13, he passed away. And I know that sort of rips a hole in you. And as a young person, or even I think as any person, if you lose someone, it's dangerous what you can fill that hole with and what you can latch onto to get over that, or use as a crutch to get through those emotional holes that you can fall into. So we sort of wanted to show that, have that hand be a representation of not only connection and a forced connection, but also vices in general.
Yeah, of course. That really comes across. I've seen that you and Michael have said that Talk to Me was originally being made with bigger studios, but they wanted to rein in some elements kind of the film. Obviously, it didn't end up sort of being made that way. But could you talk about some of those elements that you really wanted to fight for and how those kind of show up in the finished film now?
Yeah. So they really wanted to go into their notes were talking about really exploring where the hand came from and having these specialists or these expert horror experts that will come in and be like, oh, this is where the hand came from and this is how to beat it. Like, it started filling notes a bit like that I was a bit scared of. And they weren't necessarily bad notes in any way. They were actually really good notes, and they did help us with the script. But like those notes, it felt like I was losing the creative control, and they would have final cut in the edit and final say over the cast. So if we really wanted to fight for Sophie Wilde, if the studio could just say, no, that's not happening. Whereas if you made it independently with these finances, you're really able to say, yes, this is what we want to do. We can lose that budget. And when we did lose the budget for casting Sophie, I reinvested our fees into the film, me and Michael did. And then mm-hmm. So Samantha Jennings reinvested her fees as well. But yeah, it was just that have control over the cast and the script. And to also there was some hints that maybe they didn't want to shoot it in Australia and with Australian accents. And that was another thing where we were like, man, I don't know what this movie will be, or I wouldn't know how to direct something that I'm not completely connected to. Mm. So that was, yeah. And so our producer, Sam, really made us feel comfortable about taking a step away and deciding to do it independently. But it just meant that our 8-week shoot turned into a 5-week shoot and we were just up against the website. Yeah, it was so tight. But yeah.
There's no time at all, is it? God, it makes it even more impressive. I know I'm nearly out of time. I just had one very last quick question, which is that I believe you guys are set to direct the Street Fighter film. And I was just wondering if there's anything you can tell us about that and whether you loved the game as kids. Is that kind of what drew you to directing it?
Yeah. We're so in love with the game. And we'd even made a YouTube video based on the game on Raka Raka. And it's so fun. They flew us out to meet the people that made Street Fighter VI. So I met with them and I played the game with them. And then in this Capcom office, who are like the US distributor of the games, they had all these awesome statues around the room of all the Street Fighter characters, like the coolest, like life-size heads of Akuma and like all these awesome Ryu statues. And I was able to say, like, text them. And I'm like, to really help me get into the mindset of the film, I'm going to need you to send me all these statues.
Yeah, it's part of my creative process. It's part of my
creative process. Yeah, and I was able to really step up. I'm like, no, this is really going to help me write. Even though I'm not really writing the film, I'm not even attached to write. They're sending me all those statues.
Amazing. I respect that.
Because, so in love with the game. And even to really dig into the roots of Street Fighter, Michael, I traveled around Thailand and tracked down a guy named Sagat who's based on... The character in the game, Sagat Street Fighter, is based on a real person who fights in Thailand. So Michael traveled around all these fighting gyms in Thailand and tracked him down able to find places in the world that the levels are actually based on as well. So we've been really digging into the roots of Street Fighter and doing a lot of research, aka playing a lot of Street Fighter.
It's not a bad way to spend the day.
Yeah. We're so excited to have a big Hollywood budget to pull off really crazy, never before seen set pieces. Like even with our Raka Raka stuff, we were designing rigs that had never been made before. So to be able to do that on this sort of scale, man, I'm so excited. I cannot wait.
Oh wow. Well, I'm so excited now. We're all so excited, especially after seeing Talk to Me, because it's incredible. I think that's my time. But Danny, thank you so much for talking to me. Best of luck with the film. I can't wait for everyone else to see it as well.
Awesome. It was nice to meet you. Thank you for talking to me.
Sophie, you've talked to a lot of people about Talk to Me. Are you going to talk to me about Talk to Me? Are you talking to me about Talk to Me?
I am talking to you about Talk to Me.
Okay.
Yes, this is, as we said, the debut feature from Michael and Danny Philippou, and it stars Sophie Wilde as Mia, a young girl in South Australia, I believe, who has lost her mum. She's mostly living at her friend's house with her friend Jade and her younger brother Riley, who she's also close with, and their mum, who's excellently played by Miranda Otto.
Yeah.
Real star of the show. She got a lot of laughs in my screening. And essentially, there's a craze going around the young'uns, which is they've come across this kind of embalmed hand.
Ceramic on the outside, yeah.
Yeah, which is all sort of scrawled on. It's designed really well. It looks really creepy. And one of the gangs got this, and basically there's it's going viral on social media in the area. They're recording each other, shaking this hand, saying, "Talk to me," and communicating with spirits from the other side. Mia has a go and sort of gets a big kick out of it, as the other kids do, and also ends up kind of making contact with her mum, and that kind of really sort of makes her quite obsessed with it. And it sort of all spirals from there. As you can imagine, this doesn't really end well. It's not just a shake your hand and goodbye to mm-hmm. to the dead spirits. And this is really excellent. I had a great time with it. The concept itself is so good and clean and understandable and really riveting. And the direction from the Philippines, I think, is great. They sort of rose to prominence, which I've probably talked about in the interview with them, through YouTube. We'll find out.
It's fun, isn't it, doing this?
Yeah. Through their YouTube, their Raka Raka on YouTube, and they've got some wild videos that they've been making films their whole life, basically, since they were kids. And these crazy videos where they're dressed as Ronald McDonald and they're doing stunts and they're beating each other up and all sorts. And they've got all this energy, which they bring to Talk to Me a lot. It has a lot of energy to it, but it's also really disciplined, I think, mm-hmm. in its big horror sequences. And it has a really emotional undercurrent that I don't think... It's meant to be there, but I felt genuinely emotional at points in the film, because Mia has just this sense of loneliness at times that I think really gets to you. It goes to a lot of unexpected places. It's done really well, and I had a really great time with it. Don't know what you thought.
Yeah,
Helen.
No, it's very, very, very similar indeed. I feel like it's an interesting film because it feels very sort of claustrophobic almost, and closed in. Most of the outdoor scenes, and there are not very many, are at night.
Yes.
In fact, most of the film seems to take place at night. So, you know, any kind of like sunshiny idea you have of Australia is kind of irrelevant to this, and it kind of has that sort of creepiness and that idea that the darkness and the scary thing is very close to you at all times. And that works really, really well. And it does feel, you know, like any horror film, you're going, well, you're all idiots. What are you doing? You know, get out of there. Don't run upstairs. Whatever it is, call the police. Whatever it is, you know, you're usually sitting there going, oh, you're all being so ridiculous. And they absolutely are in this case, but they're also being ridiculous kind of because of peer pressure, because it's a laugh, because clearly something about this feels good, because it's funny, because it's crazy, because it's scary, you know. So it sort of has an element of believability and plausibility.
It really sells that they're having a great time with it. It was a really good montage kind of in the sort of middle section of them experimenting and all having a go, and you kind of show it going wrong, but there's enough like fun there that it just, you can kind of understand. And you know, they're teenagers and they're sitting around and they're bored and some of them are sad and
and you don't always make the best decisions, you know. And it's sort of so that I thought worked really well. John in his review compared it to Flatliners, which I think is pretty smart. Like, it has an element of that sort of playing with danger, but in a way you think is safe, in a way you think is controlled, in a way you think you have control of, and then maybe what if you're wrong? So I thought it was really well done, and it is really scary. I mean, obviously, as previously discussed many times, I am a wimp. I am very clear on that. But at the same time, this was properly scary, and it had some sudden scares, and it had some really slow building creep scares, and it just mixed up those kind of moments of sudden shock and creeping tension, I thought, really effectively. They're very good filmmakers based on this evidence.
Really, very much so. And I kind of can sound like a negative, but I felt like it was scary, but in a way that it kind of played within its own rules in a way. Like, you kind of know what to expect. It does surprise you at times, but it's not sort of putting in jump scares for shock value.
Yeah, it's
or
not cheating
it's
the scares.
Not, yeah, because that's what I really don't like in horror films. And it doesn't do that. It just kind of really takes you by the hand and leads you to these places. And the sense of place is great. Like, the soundtrack, there's a lot of Aussie music from what I can tell. You really feel like you're in that place. Yeah. And it's very modern and it's very of this time. It just has a really great energy to it. It's really, really good.
Okay, well, I tell you what, I am really, really excited to see it. It sounds terrific. I love a big horror film. I love a big horror film that is suggested by one of the minds behind Bluey as well. So, fair dinkum, I'm in for that. 4 stars then for Talk to Me.
Yeah.
Now, we should say that the new Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles movie,
Mutant Mayhem.
Mutant Mayhem is out on
Monday.
Is it Monday or
Monday?
Monday 31st. Yeah.
What's this new thing about Monday?
I think it's school holidays in this case.
School holidays.
Yeah.
All right. So that's out. We won't be reviewing that until next week properly, I guess. But have you guys seen it?
I have. And it is so much fun. It's animated in a sort of scribbly, you know, hand-drawn,
Spider-Verse-y
kind of style. It has some of that Spider-Verse-y energy. It has 4 pretty much unknowns as the turtles themselves, but like basically teenagers who they put in a room together to record. So you get all the making fun of each other and the kind of energy of like four brothers, like, you know, nudging each other in the ribs and laughing at each other. I had the best time. It's really funny. It has one of the, you know, just some of the greatest jokes of the year, and so much pace and so much energy and so much silliness. And I just loved it. It's one of the best animated films in a year that has had some great animated films.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I haven't seen this one yet.
Oh, sounds good. Sounds good. I'm all for it, Soph. Yes, Sophie hasn't seen it yet. No. I haven't seen it either. I haven't seen anything, to be quite frank. But we gave this one probably four?
I think probably four.
We
have given it four.
Gorgeous. It's a gorgeous film.
Gorgeous. It's a gorgeous film. Beautiful film.
No.
Also out is a documentary called My Name is Alfred Hitchcock by Mark Cousins, the increasingly prolific Mark Cousins, former Moviedrome host, of course, turned filmmaker. Haven't seen this one myself. I believe it's about Alfred Hitchcock. But we gave it four stars, and it's certainly something I'm going to check out at my earliest convenience. But, you know, big Hitchcock fan, big Mark Cousins fan, put those two together.
Absolutely. I'm hoping to watch it tonight, in fact, but I'm really excited to see it.
So I want to let you guys know about that one. But the final film we're going to talk about in some detail this week is on Apple TV Plus this week, and it is The Beanie Bubble. The Beanie Bubble. Hell's Bells.
Yeah, so this comes from directors Kristen Gore and Damien Kulash, and it is another one of these kind of corporate biopics. Mm. You know, we've had Air quite recently. We've had Flaming Hot. There's this, you know, Ferrari coming up, all these kind of things.
BlackBerry.
Yeah, BlackBerry. That's a thing that's happening. Tetris, of course. And this one is the story of Beanie Babies and the crazy speculative bubble that genuinely happened around Beanie Babies in the late 90s. Where people were buying these small stuffed toys and selling them for hundreds and even thousands of dollars. Yeah. And it became a sort of business for people in the early days of eBay. In fact, it kind of made eBay to trade these limited edition cuddly toys. And this is the story of Ty Warner, who founded the Ty toy company that sold Beanie Babies, who's played by Zach Galifianakis. But it's also the story of three women who played a key role in creating and popularizing these toys. So there's Robbie, who's played by Elizabeth Banks, who was his partner in the earliest days with the company. There is Sheila, played by Sarah Snook, no less, from Succession, who is his girlfriend and whose daughters actually play a role in sort of, you know, creating and consulting on some of the toys early on. And then also Maya, played by Geraldine Viswanathan from Blockers, who is the sort of the company's, she starts off as a kind of, you know, almost part-time job while she's studying medicine, but ends up, you know, developing the company's website and becoming a key part of their business strategy and certainly their online strategy in popularizing Thai, I guess, and the Beanie Babies in total. So it's really a story of the relationships that he has with these three women and the roles that they played and not just his role in designing toys, because he is basically portrayed as a guy who has a good sense of toys and a guy who can recognize a good idea when he hears one, and also a bit of a schmuck.
And really, really misguided in some of his ideas for expanding the business and communicating with people. I mean, it is a wild story and a really fascinating one. Geraldine's character, Maya, is based on a real employee called Lena Trivedi, who you see in the film, like, she really pioneers use of a website and eBay and market and demand and building community. She's the one that came up with the poems on the cards of the Beanie Babies. She's a real, like, pioneer in e-commerce, and he treated her just real bad. Well, just really undervalued her.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And indeed, you know, the others as well, both of them make significant contributions. So it's kind of a, you know, we were talking about the patriarchy last week on Barbie. Once again, we're back in the patriarchy.
Back there with more pink.
More pink again.
Plenty of pink in this film.
A lot of pink.
Any horses? Any trucks?
There is a truck that crashes that's full of Beanie Babies.
That's true.
And they spill out across the motorway.
Some of the Beanie Babies were probably horse-shaped. It became a bit hard. It was all a blur of, like, you know, plush at one point. So you kind of lost it. But I was interested throughout. I kind of, you know, I knew obviously the broad outline of the fact that these were a fad, and then they crashed spectacularly and literally in that truck metaphor. But yeah, I didn't know, you know, some of the ins and outs behind this. And I thought it did quite a good job of sort of telling that story. So yeah, I had a good time. I mean, it's not going to change the world, and it doesn't feel maybe sort of essential as a film, but it's an interesting little, you know, episode of history and an interesting look at how people get ahead, how they get undermined, how their contributions can be, you know, very, very important or very, very overlooked. And, you know, it was kind of an interesting kind of nuanced take in that respect. So yeah, I had a good choice. Really interesting performance as well. You would not, you know, it might take you a minute or two to recognize Zach Galifianakis in this. He is not leaning into any of his usual kind of, you know, energy or tricks at all.
That's good. It's been a while, really, since we've
seen him. Feels like it, yeah. It really does.
He must have deliberately stepped back. Mm-hmm. Interesting. So if you were to Barbenheimer Lewis, what would you call it? Talk to me and Beanie Bubble. Talk to Beanies. Yeah. Beanie me?
Beanie?
Yeah.
No, that doesn't sound
doesn't
right.
Doesn't work, no. Does it? It's just this wonderful confluence of events, wasn't it? It was lightning in a bottle, Barbenheimer. You can't force it.
No, it doesn't work.
No, you can't. Sorry.
Talk to Bee.
Cravens of the Flower. It doesn't work.
Mind you, if you bring in Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles, Mutant Mayhem, then you've got like Beanie Mayhem, which works pretty well.
Beanie Mayhem, yeah.
You know,
yeah.
So
Talk to Mayhem.
Talk to Mayhem. There we go. Talk to Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles.
Yeah. Okay.
Talk to Turtle with Beanie Mayhem. Boom.
Teenage Mayhem Mutant
Colon.
Bubble.
Colon.
Talk to Teenage Mutant Mutantheimers.
Talk to Beanage Mutant Ninja Turtles.
All right. 3 stars then for the Beanie
we've
Bubble.
Broken down.
It's on Apple TV Plus. And on that note, that is it, I think, for this week's Empire Podcast. Join us next week, but not Helen. Helen's away gallivanting. She's gone to a shillelagh festival in back home, which is nice. So join us next week for more film-related fun. We'll be joined by, well, unless the strike is struck, no actors or writers, and we stand behind you.
We do.
And then push you closer to the mic and then ask you questions about your upcoming project. And you go, we can't do that.
They can't do that.
And rightly so.
Right.
And we accept and we respect your decision.
Okay. So do we have any directors coming in?
Yes.
Okay, cool.
I don't know who they are.
Cool.
No, that's not true. Jeff Rowe, who is the director of Teenage Mutant Ninja Bubble. Mutant Talk to Me.
Beanie Babies.
Which is very, very exciting. And next week is the release of Ben Wheatley's The Meg 2. Ben Wheatley's The Trench, in which Ben Wheatley's Jason Statham takes on Ben Wheatley's giant shark.
Cannot wait.
Krill List, Down Terrapin, Drowned Terrace.
A Flounder in England.
White Bait Sears. It's all there. The clues were there in his filmography all along. This is Ben Wheatley's first thing. We may be getting Ben Wheatley. We're doing a VIP event, and I haven't figured out if the Q&A after that, which is going to be for the podcast, is a regular chat or a spoiler special chat. So we'll see. So maybe Ben Wheatley, definitely Jeff Rowe, and maybe even Adele Lim, who's the director of Joyride, which opens next week as well.
Is that out next week?
It's out next week, yeah.
Bang in.
I'm not here, but spoilers.
I've seen it yet. I'm dying to see it.
Come on in, Sophie. Come on in. Replace Helen.
Well, I will if I can see the film.
Permanently, fight.
Wow.
Come on, do it.
Patriarchy's at it again.
I'm talking into a pink microphone cover. All right.
What more do you want?
What do you people want from me? You people? What do you mean, you people? Okay, on that note. This parish is an absurd. Okay. That is definitely it. It's goodbye from Sophie.
Goodbye.
It's goodbye from Helen.
Toodaloo.
And it's goodbye from me. I'm off to book 2 more tickets for Barbenheimer, but this time, the other way around. That's right. It's Heimer, Barbie. Thanks so much for listening. See you next time. Bye. I don't know.